Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
I'm Kathy with a C.
And I'm Kathy with a K.
And this is Killer Destinations.
Today we continue our conversation with Monique and Marina. As you'll recall from our last episode, Monique is the founder of the nonprofit Arise for Girls with the goal of providing girls in foster care the skills and resources they need to become successful adults. And of course, Marina was a child in foster care who became a victim of the trafficking that is so prevalent among these girls. Her story took a tragic twist when she was arrested for a serious crime. So in this episode, she'll finish her story.
So within 4 months, you're arrested. So why don't you tell us about that?
Once I was introduced to the other women, it was kind of difficult because I think he knew that I was trying to leave or run away, of course. So he would have the other women watch me use the restroom. He would have the other women just basically keep an eye on me. There's been times where there has been jealousy involved because I was younger, fresh meat, you would say, I guess. And I was making more money than them. But what I can say is that once there was a lot of abuse, you know, involved and noticing that his drug addiction was going at a higher level, things started spiraling.
I'm assuming he was using meth as well, or was he using something else? Okay.
No, he was using meth.
And so as his meth abuse increased, his physical violence on you increased?
Yes. It's really difficult and hard to really understand this psychological thing, but he was obsessed with me. Like, he would tell me he don't want me doing these things, but this is what we have to do to, you know, so it was kind of weird. So what ended up happening is that, yes, I was doing dates, but there was a time that, you know, I would still get abused by him. So I wouldn't understand how do you love and care and you want me to do this, but you're abusing me. And I would get beat up black and blue, like literally. And it wasn't just me. It was, you know, other women.
In other words, by him?
By other.
Okay, so like you were being beaten by him and other women were being beaten by him.
Yes.
The way you said it, I wasn't sure if the women were involved in the beating. That's all.
And was he keeping all the money that you earned?
Yes.
Okay, so you saw none of the money.
None.
Raise your hand. Monique is raising her hand. Yes, Monique?
I have a question. So on a good day, how much money would you give him?
On a good day, yeah, it could be up to like $800, $1,000.
Did you ever keep any money for yourself and not tell him?
No.
Too afraid of what would happen if he found out?
Yes.
So did he do the math? Like, did he know every time you were going on a date?
Yes, he did.
Okay, so he knew how much you would have to give him.
Well, it wasn't like a quota type thing. It was just like, hey, this is what I made. But majority of the time, he would follow me on whichever date that I make. So if I'm going in a car, he would be right behind that car to make sure nothing happened to me or I wasn't taking advantage of him or the date wouldn't rob me or whatever so maybe.
Do these Johns know that? I mean, just out of, like, do they know? Okay.
And he will make me, like, when I did have a phone, he would make me put it on speaker and put it in my bra so that he knows everything that's going on. He would tell me, like, hey, if you did lose the car, if I lose the car, make sure you constantly on the phone saying what kind of car you're in. Like, describe the car, describe the person, everything.
So if you're giving him the money and you're doing what you're supposed to be doing for him, why was he hitting you at all? Was it his way of saying, you're not leaving me?
Yes. And then there was this one time that we were in the car. It was just me and him, and we got pulled over. And the gun was underneath the seat, but he had his security jacket on.
His what? I'm sorry?
Security jacket.
Security jacket. Okay.
Because he was a security guard, correct?
He was a security guard. And he basically told the police that he was coming from work and he has a guard card. And when I tell you, it was a complete shock that they just let us be. They just left and we went on our day.
So wait, what was he pulled over for?
I don't remember.
When he was pulled over and the cops came to the door, what were you thinking?
I was thinking, oh my God, I'm going to be saved now. You know, like, okay, good. They're going to search the car and I'm, you know, boom. But then a part of me felt like because it was only two of them, this man could possibly just kill these police officers and then I will have to be taken with this man again. So it was a 50-50 thing.
Okay, so tell us how you became arrested.
So what ended up happening is that he started getting more greedy. He was drinking, doing drugs. And then I started noticing that he would, you know, like I was saying, I felt like he was obsessed with me in some weird way. There started coming a time that he started walking up behind the car that I was in, and he would rob and kill these people in front of me.
Rob and kill?
Yes.
How many times did he do that in front of you?
Three times.
Three times?
Right.
Wow. That is so sad. So, like, he would, like, come up to the driver's side and just, wow.
Yeah.
Three times over the course of how long?
Two of them had happened in 1 month, which was back-to-back in a week. And then another one was in another month. But eventually, we went to a different county in Riverside. And something else happened. It didn't really have to do with me on a date. It had to do with gangbanging in some sort. And because he was so angry, he was mad at us for some reason. And I already know we didn't do anything wrong. But he was just in that mindset of, I'm mad at y'all. Y'all lucky I don't kill you type of mentality. And I guess for some reason, he saw this man standing outside an apartment, some African-American man. And I guess he saw that he was looking weird at him, or he assumed that the person was looking weird at him. And he bust a U-turn and he asked the man where he was from. And I was in the front seat. And yeah, it was crazy. So he basically, you know, exchanged where they were from. And he shot at him.
He shot the man on the sidewalk?
No, in front of his apartment complex. The person ran away, but eventually I ended up finding out that he didn't make it. So in my mind at the time, I was like, okay, yeah, good. He ran away, you know, but he didn't make it.
As far as him driving down the street and he made a U, so the guy was standing in front of the apartment building. He was standing outside on the curb or...
No, it was an apartment complex. This was in Riverside. I don't really know how their apartment works, but he was just standing outside with the bike. I think it was a bike. I could be wrong, but he was just standing outside smoking a cigarette or something. Mm-hmm. And in my mind, I'm just listening to him ranting because he was talking about what he was saying with us. And then I hear him say something about some man looking at him weird. And we bust the U-turn so quick. At that time, I started understanding how narcissistic he was and crazy he was. But I couldn't really do anything because I knew at my place that if I did something, I was going to die. So I had to be emotionless to anything that he does. Because if I showed emotion, he would let me know that he would kill me.
And so when he shot that man, he had to reach across you. Yes. To do it.
Yes. So there was hot bullets falling on my lap. Yeah.
And so the three men that were shot previously, the Johns, did they all die? Do you know?
Yes.
Okay. So you're in Riverside. He shoots this other man. You think the man survives, but he doesn't. You found out later he died. Okay. So tell me how you guys got arrested. Tell me what happened.
So what happened is that we was going towards his neighborhood in Los Angeles and we got pulled over and they said something about his headlight, but he knew that nothing was wrong with his headlight. And the thing is that it wasn't a regular police car. It was like a cruiser, some type of cruiser. So that happened. We stepped out the car and, you know, we got up against the gate and the police asked me what happened to your face because I had a black eye around that time. And because he was so dangerous and so crazy and psychotic, I still believe because of that incident with the police car and they letting him go that I didn't tell them what happened to me. I said that I got jumped at high school and that was it. What ended up happening is that they ended up separating us and taking us one by one. But I think we all knew that we were getting caught up for everything that happened because there was helicopters. The street got blocked off. There was more police coming every minute, every 5 minutes. It was like 7 police cars. There was a helicopter and then plus that cruiser. So I think we knew like, okay.
Who is we? How many people were in the car?
So it was, at that time, you would call it my co-defendant, and then it was the male, and then it was me.
So when you say the co-defendant, was it another girl who was working for him?
Yes.
Okay, so two girls, and then...
There was two girls, but at that time, she wasn't in the car when we got pulled over.
So in the car getting pulled over was him, you, and somebody else?
Yes.
Okay, and that somebody else was a woman as well?
Yes.
So they separate you, and then what happens?
So we get separated, and we go to the police station, then they question all of us. But like I said, I'm so traumatized from the situation that happened with the police car and him going away. I don't know if they're in cahoots. I don't know who to trust. So I didn't give them a name. I gave them the name that I had to create when I was giving to John. So I gave Faith Johnson. And that was the name that I was putting in the John's phone if they wanted to date again. They found that number in the car, one of the people's car that had passed away, the number that I guess they had linked it. And I don't know if that was the reason how they found us, but they was like, who's this person? Because that's the name I gave them to him. They was like, who's this? And they were asking me questions. And eventually I let them know, like, hey, this is my name. I'm in foster care. And then they took me to like a shelter.
And you're still 16 at this
yes,
time.
They took me to a shelter and they was like, okay, we might question you, but for now you can go. And I was like, whew, like I'm good. I'm safe. And it was crazy because that night I was talking to some other girls and I didn't say anything. I didn't tell them what was going on with me, but they were trying to leave and run away because the way it was set up, that shelter is that you can walk out if you want to, you know, as a homeless person, whatever. So we were going to leave, like literally we were going to leave and the police came back and got me.
And they picked you up and took you where?
Back to the police station.
Did they put you in juvie at that time?
Yes.
Or so what killing was it that they were arresting you for? Was it the three in L.A. or the yes. one in Riverside? The three in L.A.
No, it was everything. But they didn't really know much around that time. But eventually we were charged for everything. Everybody was equally charged.
Like co-conspirators.
Yes. So my first court date, they charged me with 3 murders, 2 robberies and attempted murder. So I was looking at 50 to life.
You weren't charged as a juvenile, even though you were 16?
I was charged as a juvenile still.
Okay. And that's 50 to life?
Yes.
Wow.
So let me go back. I was starting to go to juvenile court and they had to find out if I was unfit for the criteria. I could either stay as a juvenile hall or they would charge me as an adult. Eventually, they was like, she doesn't fit all the criteria to stay as a juvenile. Send her to adult court. So I started getting on a bus with the adults. So they would send me to a different juvenile hall that would pick up the bus that has adults in it. And I would go to court. When I first went to that court date, that's what they told me I was charged with. Until we started going to court and I was sentenced for almost 3 years. So I was in juvenile hall. Then I was placed in county because I turned 18. And I was sitting in there for 3 years. And then that's when I got sentenced.
I'm sorry, that's when you what? They lowered what?
My sentence. So I was in juvenile hall for like a year and a half. Almost 2 years. And then I went to county for 2 years.
Were you alleged to have knowingly set up these men on a date knowing they were going to be robbed? Was that part of the allegations against you?
Yes, they said I was conspiracy too. Like I knew what I was doing.
And did you?
I'm not going to say no, but not really. And the reason why I say that is because it didn't happen every single time. So it was like the first time was a shock. And I was like, okay, maybe he'll never do that again. And then, you know, I had more dates and then it happened again. And then it's like, third one was like, I don't know what's going to happen to you, but I'm going to keep my mouth shut because, you know.
You don't want to be killed.
Right. The people that he told me that I was allowed to, you know, go on a date with was Hispanic men, only Hispanic.
Oh, that's interesting. Why is that?
Because majority of either, I want to say Caucasian or African-American men would either take me or try to do the same thing he was doing, but acknowledging, know that they could take me and they have me as their own.
Oh, as in like take you as their girl now?
Either girl or pimping, I guess.
Like, yeah. Okay.
I've seen girls, some of the girls that happens where they take them out of state. Some of the Caucasian men, I've seen them go out of state with them and keep them. I have a kid that I know that's in Vegas, you know, and she'll call me every now and then and say, I want to get out. But she's had all of his kids now, you know, so he holds the kids over her head like, oh, if you leave, I'm going to take because you're unfit. I'll tell them what you were doing. Da 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 da. So she just stays. But I still believe he traffics her from state to state because she'll call and say, I'm over here. And then he'll leave her. And then she has to figure out how to get back to Vegas. And they'll go into a truck stop and he'll just leave her. So I can see that because I've heard those type of stories.
And so then at some point during the sentencing, Monique came back into your life.
Yes.
Tell me how that happened.
What happened was, I want to say maybe like 2 weeks within me being in juvenile hall, my social worker came to visit me in juvenile hall and she was like out of it. She was so shocked that everything happened to me. And when she found out what was going on, she literally told me like I was getting ready to quit my job because of what happened to you. And she said this because they couldn't find me. And I guess there were some sort of dental find where they had identified a girl's teeth. And I guess she was burnt up on the side of the road and her teeth marks was the same as mine. And they told her like, hey, do you know this person? And she thought I was dead. she said, girl, I was going to quit my job because.
Wow.
And this is somebody that knew me from, I think, like what, 11, 12 till 16. So she'd been with me the whole time. So she have created this bond where she knew who I was. She knew who my family was. So she found that I was dead. She probably would have been like, I can't do this no more.
Right.
I apologized to her because I was like, I don't know, like, because I was going through it. But she was like, okay, well, I know where you at. We're going to figure this out.
And at this point, you're facing 50 to life.
Yes.
Okay.
But when she seen me, I was in juvenile court around that time. So that's why she was like, well, we'll figure this out, because I was in juvenile hall court. I was in adult court around that time. But my social worker had reached out to Monique and asked her, like, hey, do you think you can come to court and help Marina? You have to, you know, basically say something, because this is not who she is. I don't know what they're making her out to be. I don't know what happened, but I need help.
That's exactly what she said. We started talking about all of this prior to you getting into adult court.
Mm-hmm.
So I went down there and I did talk to the DA and all of them in the room. And then we kind of, they asked me what was her demeanor and what was she like in my home and things like that. And they were saying, did I believe that he coerced her? I said, yeah, of course I do. And she said 50 to life. And then I was like, oh no. When they said 50, I was like, no, she can't go to jail for 50, because this is not right. Because I know how timid she was, because she was a very timid girl in my home. So I talked about that, Marina, to the court. So I went to court, talked to the prosecutors and all of them. And then they started saying, well, tell us about her so that we can figure out how to make a deal or get her sentence reduced or what she's looking at. And then, so I kind of went in and told her about her demeanor and who she was. And they kept saying, do you believe she was not in on it? I said, I believe that she wasn't in on it, because Marina is very, at the time, I ain't gonna say that, Marina. Was very timid, very persuasive. You know, I can believe that they said go out there on the street. And they kept saying, because she said she was scared. And I said she was scared. And they didn't believe she was scared. That's another thing, because I kept thinking she was scared. She was scared. Anybody would be scared, you know. And I'm like, I know she wasn't going out. And they said, well, she was luring these men. And I said, no, I don't think so. She was luring them because she was told to lure them, not because she literally was out there saying, let me just go do this. No. So that's kind of how I stepped back into her life at that point, because I had not seen her since she left my house and went back home to her dad. And then that's when her social worker reached out. I need your help again, because they know how I care for the kids and I don't want to see her go to jail. So she's like, hey, I need your help to come over here and help me get this girl not to be in jail for the rest of her life.
And so what did your sentence wind up being?
My sentence ended up being voluntary manslaughter and two robberies.
Did you plead?
Yes.
And so how much time did you wind up getting?
I ended up getting 11 years.
And was that 11 new years, or did you get time served already?
I did get time served from the time that I did in county.
And so how much time did you actually have to serve in prison?
I think it was 10 years and some days, but I ended up doing like 9.5.
And where'd you serve your time?
I gradually leveled down a lot because of my behavior. Don't get me wrong, I've had bad times too. But I went to Chowchilla, and then from Chowchilla, I went to CIW. From CIW.
CIW is the California Institute for Women in Corona, California.
Yes. And then I went to Folsom State Prison for Women.
I didn't even know that Folsom had a women's prison.
It's very small.
I just thought it was Johnny Cash.
So, yeah, it's very, very small. And then I kind of got into a little bit of trouble and I went back to Chowchilla, and then I went to CIW again. And then from CIW, I had like good behavior. I was 2 years left, and then I went to an outside facility where I can be on the streets, but I had an ankle monitor on in Los Angeles. And then I got into a little bit of trouble and then went back to prison. And then I came home.
What, if you're willing to say, got you back into prison after you had served all that time?
When I was in a facility, CCTRP, that's what they call it. So basically, you're still doing time, but you're doing time in a facility outside of prison. So what happened is that me personally, I felt like I was too open to my story, to where staff had clinged to me. So they felt like, you know, I wasn't ready for the world.
What do you mean?
And I'm going to explain.
Okay.
So the facility is called Amity Foundation. And they like to make sure that, you know, you're comfortable with your story. They make sure that you're healing so they can help you get ready for a job. And they want to make sure you're mentally stable. So I was going to school. I was going to Chaffey College. And I was in the midst of that. I was waiting to get leveled up to go take a job. And I started noticing that people after me when I came there is getting a job. And I'm like, hey, what's going on? And be like, we don't really think you're ready. And I've been waiting and waiting and waiting. I'm still doing my college classes. And, you know, some girls was like, hey, you know, we have the access to, you know, we broke the internet, basically. So I got on Facebook. We weren't supposed to get on Facebook and have outside contact like that. And I got caught. So it was like, you got to go back. But see, the reason why I did that is because at the time we are able to get our own boxes and have our own money. But if I'm not able to make my own money, that means I have to contact family. And I wasn't able to do that over this county phone that you have to pay for. And so I took advantage to try to get in contact with my family so they can help me so I can live my everyday life. Hey, can you help me with the package? Da, 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 da. And I wasn't able to do that because they wouldn't allow me to get a job because they thought I wasn't ready.
What was the original phone call that made somebody think you needed to be in foster care? Was it neglect? Were you going to school dirty?
Till this day, I do not know who made the call.
But what was it?
But do you know what the reason behind the call was?
It was neglect. I guess it was neglect. Okay. But I mean, I don't know. But they said it was neglect.
Did you feel like you had a clean house or not a clean house? Did you? I'm just curious. Like if you saw yourself as a little girl, like an 11-year-old.
I can say now in my right mind, I can say the house wasn't perfect, but was I fed? Was I taken care of? Yes. Yes.
Do you mean like the house itself, like the bathrooms didn't work or, you know, that kind of thing? Or is it?
In other words, a lot of people call it hoarding, but yeah.
Oh, so your dad was a hoarder.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, well, right. Okay. Okay, so if you look back at yourself when mom died and you didn't get the appropriate attention and sympathy, had that not happened or you gotten the appropriate level of care and attention, where do you think your life was headed?
Definitely down the right path. Most definitely, I was going to church. I was going to school. I was doing everything I was supposed to. So I definitely think I would have went in the right path because she wasn't a bad woman. My foster mom, she just, I felt like at the age that she was at, I really think she should have just retired. I think what comes with age is wisdom, but then you have such short patience when you're older. So
that's so true.
I felt like maybe that was a big, big thing, but she was a good woman. She introduced me to God. We were going to church. I never really said anything bad about her. But when it came to grieving and losing someone, I know she've lost her twin. So I felt like she probably wasn't healed and she was going through other things. She was battling cancer. I felt like it was a bad combination at that time. But no matter what you're going through, if you have a foster kid, you're supposed to set aside what you're going through and make sure that I'm okay. And I took it upon myself to do whatever I felt like I needed to do.
And so you and Monique have stayed in touch.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18+ in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.
Was it stayed in touch ever since Moni talked to the district attorney about sentencing, or have you been the entire time?
No, while she was locked up, no.
Okay.
So after a while, I was doing time. I've been out, I want to say I've been out maybe a year and a half, 2 years now from when I started talking back to Monique. And I got in contact with my social worker. I always stayed in contact with her. She's a good person. And I was asking her about her opinion on something. And she told me, hey, you know, Monique is trying to contact you. And because I don't talk to my social worker every day. It's like maybe once every 4-5 months. So, and I was like, oh, okay, give me her number. And she gave me her number and I called Monique. Or I don't know if I called you or it was the other way around.
You okay, called
so
me.
I called you.
You called me.
And then and she was like, girl, where you been?
And so she's sort of a mentor now to you, yes. Obviously. Are you going to be involved in a Rise for Girls?
Oh, I'm like, yeah, I'm thinking you're going to answer that.
Yeah.
I'm like, why wouldn't you be? I already told you that.
Yes.
So, Marina, I want to go back to a point. You had said that this pimp was in a gang. And so how prevalent is this a problem with respect to gangs? Were you in a gang? How did it affect you? Like, tell me the dynamics of
gangs.
Yeah, exactly.
I was never in a gang. He was in a gang. I've been in the neighborhood of where he was from a lot, but it's never been really like a time and place where like, hey, we're hanging out, you know, we're in this function of all these people. And no, he was really separated from that. But it was a stated known fact that he was from a gang.
But because he was treating you as though you were his property.
Yes.
Would other people have considered you to be part of his gang?
It's a funny question that you say that, because there was a time that I was really like reaching out and screaming for help. So in my mind, I really thought that maybe my family could help me with this problem. And I wasn't thinking about my family's safety. So what I did was I told him that I need to go get some clothes. So I went to my grandmother's house, and this was in his, I don't know how to say it, a rival neighborhood from him. And I didn't know that. So he dropped me off. He was pretty upset about it, but eventually, you know, I talked to my grandmother about it. And it's crazy because as weird as this may sound, where she's not from, she's not my grandmother, she's not from a gang, but where she kind of grew up is that if you're hanging with somebody, right, or you're dealing with this person, then you're a part of that in some way, voluntary or not voluntary. She didn't really say, hey, that's your problem. But I was kind of like asking for help. Like, how can I need help? Like, this is what's going on. But then again, she was pushing me away, too, because she didn't want it to come into her house.
So what kind of help were you asking for, though? Like, as a place to stay? Because
yes, a place to stay. Can I, like, a runaway? Like, hey, can I stay here? And hopefully, you know, he doesn't know where I'm at.
And then but that will disassociate you?
Yeah, because I had him drop me off, like, literally around the corner. And I would hear him, like, calling my name. I would hear his car, you know, going in circles. And I didn't understand. Now I know. But I didn't understand how mad he was because where he's from, he's constantly looking for me in his area that he's not supposed to be in. But I was basically trying to hide, but my grandmother was like, you can't stay here. So I had to go back. But my sister, she's really my niece, but my sister, you know, when I went back, they walked me back, and she said, like, literally, like, when she took me back to this man, she saw death. She saw everything in his face that said danger. But it was to the point where, I don't know how to explain it, it was like a sacrifice type of thing where it's like, okay, we're going to walk you back, but you can't stay here. But we know this man got a gun. So it was really difficult and it was weird. But I ended up going back to him. I ended up getting back in a car with him. And they knew what was going on, but they didn't really say too much, you know? And this was like, my niece was there when I got back in the car with him. So it's like, they kind of like pushed that under a rug and really say too much. Because again, they're used to something like this in a way, but they didn't really know how severe it was.
You talked about beatings he gave you.
Yes.
Like, what else? Like, what would be...
Like, did you end up in the hospital for any of them?
No. It wasn't, okay, I beat you up, let's go to the hospital. It was never none of that.
Well, not that he took you. I just didn't know if you ever wound up taking yourself to the hospital.
No, but there was a time that he knew that he beat me bad where I'm not able to be...
Making money.
Right. So he took me to one of his friend's house and did this weird magical eye shot glass cut thing that I guess is going to help me go away with my black eye. And it did help, but that didn't solve half of the problems that was going on with my body. But yeah.
As far as keeping you from running away, keeping you from running out of the house in the middle of the night, did he take any measures or did he trust that he scared you enough that you would not leave?
I think he trusts me enough that he scared me enough I wouldn't leave. But there has been a time where I was so extremely, extremely tired from him threatening me, because I would literally sacrifice and make stories every day to let him know, like, don't kill me. You know, I've said so many things so that he wouldn't kill me. But it came to the point where I was so tired and I told him, I was like, can I just call my family? Because I don't care what you do at this point, because that's how drained and tired my body was that I don't even care anymore. And he didn't. He didn't do anything. But that next 3 days is when we got caught up. So it was crazy. But I felt like that was just like an angel saying, you know what, this something has to happen.
So obviously we want to know how you're doing and how you're succeeding. But really, what have your challenges been getting back to what your new normal is? Because not only has society changed quite a bit, as has technology, but also even getting a job. So we'd love to know where you are and all of that.
The day that I got released, I asked for a phone. But what I really want to let you guys know is that the main thing that was my problem, I was eager to come home. I was eager to get a job. I was eager to start my life. But mentally, I was still trapped in everything that was going on with me, of, you know, coming home and the anxiety of what can happen now that they know that I'm out. Because you have to understand, once you're released, your co-defendants and the victim's family are aware that I am released. So in my mind, I'm thinking anything could happen to me at any moment. So my anxiety was out the roof.
Was this guy still in prison?
Yes.
And what about your co-defendant?
Yes, they were. So till this day, I have really, really bad anxiety. I can't say that I'm completely healed, but I'm on a stable journey. As you guys know, I was 16 when I got locked up. So it's like, I feel like I'm literally walking all over again, like a little toddler, like learning how to walk all over again. Before, I knew how to take a train, I knew how to take a bus, but it's like, come on, now it's been 10 years. My anxiety, my mental is like completely off balance where it's like, I don't know what I'm doing. I need somebody to hold my hand. So the day that I got out, honestly, I had so much anxiety, I threw up twice, like, because I didn't know what was going to happen to me. I knew I was in a safe place and I was with my family, but it's like, oh my gosh, I made it out because the things that I went through in prison as well.
And I can see that too. I mean, not even knowing exactly what happens in prison, no matter where you are, you're struggling to survive. Like, you must have been exhausted because you were on high alert the whole time you were there. But really quickly, you said you were with your family. Were you with your father, siblings?
No. Eventually, what happened is because I was in foster care about a year and some change. I remember my sister telling me that my dad was sick, but I was still a kid. So sick is like sick, you get better, whatever. But end up finding out that she meant sick cancer. So while I was in juvenile hall, my dad passed away from cancer. So it was really hard for me to deal with that. And then a month before my dad passed away, my nephew passed away too. So it was really hard because like my stepmom, my nephew, my dad, I felt like I didn't have anybody no more. But I had my sisters. So my sister picked me up and I stayed with her one night. And the next day I had to report to parole. So they put me in a organization where they will basically help me rehabilitate myself to a natural everyday basis of living. That was voluntary. Or I could have chose to just go back to the streets, go living life, whatever you want to do, just as long as you report. And I had to really make a strong decision because I had something, but I didn't have much. So I really had to ground myself and tell myself, like, I know I don't have anything. So let me just go to this program and hopefully it'll help me build my own foundation and really help me go through an everyday life basis situation. So once I went to the program, they told me, they welcomed me open arms. But when it came down to me having to pay my first bill, it was like, oh my gosh, this is my first time paying rent. This is a first time thing. This is a first moment. Like, this is a part of adulthood. So this is why I say it's a mental thing, because it's like, this is already advanced to people that are my age now, but this is my first time doing this. So it was a challenge, but it was achievement, paying my own rent, finding my own job, stuff like that. Because of the program that I was in, they helped me find a job. So because I was so eager to, like, because I've been sitting down for a long time, I'm gonna say that I've been sitting down for a long time. So I was trying to take 3 jobs if I could. And, you know, I started off small. I started in a janitorial little job. It wasn't easy, but I was willing to put in the work to do what I have to do to get a better life. And then, you know, I was still doing therapy. And then the program kind of told me, hey, we have an independent house. You can go on. We don't have to supervise you. You know, we see that you're doing your everyday needs. So I moved to an independent house where now I have to buy my own tissue. I have to put my big girl panties on and get into that adulthood. And I did. So that wasn't easy. I was still, you know, calling on family, seeing if they helped me as much as they could. And I started noticing, like, they started letting me know, like, hey, you're not a baby no more. You have to try. And I did. I did start trying. It wasn't easy. Mentally, it was not easy because I really felt like, man, if my parents were here, if my stepmom was here, if my dad was here, I wouldn't have to deal with nothing. Like, that I knew because I was like a princess. I was like, I don't want none of this. Somebody else do it. So that was really hard for me. So once I started getting into that and I started saving my money and, you know, therapy, they told me, like, hey, you know, we have this housing thing you could do. I applied for it. Then I got my first apartment. That's when I was just like, wow.
How long was that after prison?
When that was getting out? Almost 2 years.
Okay. So about 6 months into being home, you were able to get into this housing.
Yes. So I finally got my apartment. So that was a huge challenge too, because now I had to pay my own rent. I had to get my own supplies, get my own couch, bed.
Do you have a roommate?
No, I have my own one bedroom apartment. So that was a big accomplishment for me, because all this time I've been dealing with women and sharing and dealing with their hormones. And I just needed my own space. And I was so happy. I felt like that was one of the hugest accomplishments. The first accomplishment is I got my diploma in juvenile hall. So I was like, OK, you know, I did something good. And then, you know, I was taking Chaffey College. I was doing that, but then I got sent back. So that was another thing. But when I was inside, I was taking classes. I was doing everything I was supposed to do. It's not easy. There's times where you have to do what you have to do to maintain your business. But okay, now I got my own apartment. So I'm just like, wow, I'm supposed to be doing this. So now I need to get a job again. So now I need to maintain my apartment. That is very hard because some people say, oh, it's kind of easy if you have a background. But then again, it's not. Because there's only so many people that'll hire you. And then you have transportation. So that's my problem now is transportation. I don't know how to drive to this day. So it's like, I have to learn that. But now I catch the bus. I do what I have to do. But the area that I'm living in and the job that I want is so far away. And I'm just like, ugh, everyday headaches. But what I can say is that I'm grateful because these are the things that I prayed for when I was inside. I was hoping that, you know, I can have these challenges. I was praying that I can go through these things because I thought I would never make it out, you know, dealing with what I was dealing with. Right. So now that I'm dealing with it, it's a headache, but I take every day with a grain of salt. Like, okay, now while I was going through, you know, having my own apartment, I was working at organizations. I was advocating for women. I was going up to the Capitol legislation, like trying to create bills, advocating for the community.
This is all in the last couple of years?
Yes.
Ah.
The jobs that I've been having, I've been advocating. Like, I've been advocating for people that's been formerly incarcerated or that's, you know, troubled youth. And so that matter. And I'm starting to notice, like, this must be my passion because this is the only thing that I noticed that has been going so smoothly.
Now, has that been volunteer work or is that something you're getting paid to do?
Some is volunteer. Some I would get paid. Now, I'm actually getting ready to go on this trip where I take these kids as a staff. I'm part of a staff group where I take these kids to go see their father for the first time in prison. It's called Place for Grace. But it's really crazy to me how God is constantly putting me in these situations where, hey, I think this might be your calling, you know?
Did you get involved in that through your church or the nonprofit that you're talking about?
Yes, I got it through there.
You know, I think that all of us do have God-given gifts. We don't always know what they are. Sure. Sometimes it takes a smack upside the head, but sometimes it takes a path like yours and all the work that you're doing now. And it would make sense to me that you are teamed up with Monique for Arise for Girls. And your journey was so sad and crazy and encouraging at the same time. So I think you would be a perfect mentor for a young foster youth who was kind of teetering on the edge of something that it's like, am I going to zig or am I going to zag? You know, where do you want to see yourself in 5 years?
I can say right now, I'm not sure because I really take life at an everyday basis because literally for the past 2 months, miscellaneous things been happening. And it lets me know as a life lesson that things jump in the front of the road and life shows up and life happens. So I can't really give you that answer. I can tell you what I want to happen. I can tell you what I wish to happen, but I cannot tell you what is going to happen because I don't know.
I can accept that. But
well, and it's an honest answer, too, yes. Because there's so much in front of you. Do you worry? So like you're talking about needing to get a job, but you've got rent and other bills to pay and all of that. Do you ever worry that you're going to wind up back on the blade, that you're going to wind up having to do something you don't want to do for money?
It's funny you ask me that because when I had got out 2 years ago, I had a situation with my sister, the same sister that came and picked me up. What happened is that, you know, she brought me a phone and, you know, she has supported me throughout my time as much as she could as a sister. And I appreciate that. But what ended up happening is that because she got me that phone, I felt like she was obligated to let me know, like, I don't think you should talk to this person. I don't think you should talk to that person. And I was like, you know what? Okay. But then eventually she asked for the phone back. And mind you, this is the same sister that kind of, I accumulated a lot of stuff while I was inside and I sent it to her house. And I was like, okay, that's, you know, that's fine. You can have the phone back. And I asked her, I said, hey, when is it possible that you can bring my stuff? And she was kind of like, I guess, fed up in a way where she thought she could just tell me what to do and she couldn't as a sister. So it's a sister thing. So in the back of my mind, my first thing is I have to start over. So I only could go off of what I know. So yes, that mentality has been brought in my mind, or I have had that stinking thinking where it's like, well, maybe I do have to sell drugs, or maybe I do have to sell my body to get quick access of money so I can get the things that I need. Has it happened? No. And I'm glad that it hasn't. But I know that, you know, that's never going to happen.
But it's also like somebody who has gone through rehab. So let's say they're
right, that's exactly what
drug of choice is cocaine and they've been clean for 6 months and they really, really want it. Their inner brain is telling them,
right,
you know, you can do a lot to fool yourself. The best thing to do is turn to your sponsor and say, I'm really craving cocaine right now. You just have to tell the truth. When we are able to actually just say the truthful words out loud.
As hard as they are to say.
And
it's like half the battle,
really,
I swear.
It really, really is hard to say. What a lot of people don't understand, for one, as a woman, for two, as an African-American woman, is that how some people grow up is to be seen and not heard. And to me, I feel like as women, we're so used to be controlled by men. And he's my support system. He's paying this and he's paying that. And I don't have nothing. I have to stay here. What am I going to do? I have these kids. So we're used to being underneath. And then when it's time for us and we don't have nothing, we only go with what we know. So it's a lot of women do that. When I have conversation, yeah. That's the first thing they think about. They will be crying and they will tell me, I don't have nothing and I don't know what to do. These are women that have had education. These are women that has nothing. These are women that comes from poverty. The first thing they think of is selling their body. A lot of women don't know that there's a lot of resources out here. And the thing is, I could tell a million women there's resources, but then you have to hold their hand. You have to direct them. Hey, the resources are here. You can get them at any time. You can't just tell a person there's resources out there. Go find them. No. Half of these women might not have a car or not educated to know or be directed. It takes time. But I mean, you can't save the world, but it doesn't hurt to help the next person.
And you know what, Monique, that actually reminds me of something you said when we talked a couple months ago, where we were talking about not having cars. And you had said, people don't inherently know how to take the bus.
Mm-hmm.
And you just need to teach one person, because there is that anxiety. I totally get when you were talking about it earlier, but you teach them, you walk them through it. This is how you do it. This is whatever. Yes. And they've got the city at their feet.
Yeah, it is. And next month, I do have Simone coming down from New York, and she's going to come and talk about finances and careers, because guess what? A lot of people don't understand about finances and careers. The population and what I deal with, they have no hope. What they see is nowhere beyond that little pocket. So there's no businesses in LA. We see downtown LA, but they don't know what they do in downtown LA. They see what's here, and McDonald's is the closest thing to them, or Ralph's, maybe a grocery store. But no type of businesses where they can go, okay, this is what I'm doing. And the businesses that are there are Department of Social Services. We go there just to get gain, or we go there to get some type of Social Security, or we go here to get this type of thing. So that's the only type of help that they normally see, or that's what they think. You know, this is where we go. We go here to Department of Social Services to get county checks or whatever they want to call it. And that's what I want Arise to be known for, is to teach them that there is something beyond this area, that there's things out here that you can obtain and not be afraid of to go and obtain it. And that it does take education. It does take hard work. But if I show you and give you the tools on how to do this, then it's easier to obtain. I have Simone coming in from SCA Strategies that they will come in and they're going to teach the girls about careers and financing. And because I believe to get someone out of poverty, to get someone out of that type of mindset, we would have to show them the tools of finances. This is how you do this. This mm-hmm. is what money is about.
But the other thing, too, when you had talked about having one of your former foster kids who graduated from Loyola Marymount University, mm-hmm. you were telling us about the fact that there are so many kids in foster care don't even know about the FAFSA that can get them the yeah. loans and the grants that they need to be able to actually go to a university. And you don't know what
and
you don't know.
She did not pay a dime to go there. That was awesome and the most amazing thing I have ever seen, though. That just blew my mind.
So one of the things, too, just to kind of take it back to the beginning is, we were talking about foster care, and Kathy and I did a little bit of research that in Los Angeles County, there's about 25,000 foster kids, state of California, about 60,000. And in the U.S., almost 450,000 kids are in foster care. Not asking for percentages, but is trafficking something that a lot of foster kids have to worry about?
Of course. I can't believe that if you put the majority of the people who identify even as a DV, which is domestic violence or human trafficking, because they, to me, go both hand in hand. Somebody could be domestic violence and never tell you there was trafficking. Somebody can be human trafficking and never say that they were beat or put into a situation, but they are commingled. Foster care, domestic violent victims, and human trafficking. Always. All three. Always. I haven't seen too many cases where they have not been in foster care. And so the book that we did last year, The Foster Care Story, is about the intersection of human trafficking and foster care, and where a majority of the children are coming across foster care. So the women in the book were in foster care and human traffic.
Tell us about the book.
The book is a nonprofit out of Texas, Empty Frames Initiative. I love their mission because most of the foster children exit out of foster care without pictures. So Empty Frames is trying to give them a sense of home and a sense of belonging. So we did abstract paintings or pictures to tell my childhood story. And so it is a way of showing the foster youth how to heal by telling their stories through pictures. So whether they didn't remember their mother's home, but they remember it was blue, but they don't know where it's at. I hiked up the hill to Hollywood sign and I took a picture of LA sitting from that view and looking out over the city and just glimpsing, like, what did I think about LA growing up? And how did I get to the point of where I'm at? And how did I become into foster care? I've always loved LA. That's why I stayed here. I stayed within the center, but I loved LA, and I always had a sense of wanting to see LA great, to help everybody. So as I looked over the city, I just kept thinking, it's beautiful here. So my story in the book was about me growing up in LA, growing up in a multicultural home, and knowing that we were all woven together. We are different, but we're woven together with love. And that's kind of the message of Arise. It's just wanting to shine love into the darkness of people, and just so that they can feel hope and love and joy. And the sound of Arise is restore, renew, and rejoice with each girl that comes through our door.
If everybody listening to this podcast donates $5 to ariseforgirls.org, the amount of good that you are going to do and the amount of love that you are going to spread is going to be incredible. I would encourage you to do as much as you can, but I would love to see every listener with $5.
And we will put a link in our Instagram on our link tree so that you could just easily go to the site to see what they're all about, read a little bit more, and make a donation.
Marina, do you have anything else you want to say or add? Anything else you want to communicate?
I think what I can say is that, like, out of everything you said, I feel like the main thing that is really important is showing love, as well as mental health. Your mental health is so, so important, because I feel like some people grow up not understanding, you know, they just do, but not understanding the mental health of what's going on with them. And I started noticing that later on now that it's really important. And a lot of people, they don't even see that something is normal or not normal. A lot of people do a lot of things, but they're not really caring for themselves. And that can overturn to something else. So I really think that mental health is really important, as well as showing a lot of love. So I definitely want to put that in there.
Thank you for listening. Up next in this three-part series is a conversation with Tanette. Tanette was born into a family where sexual abuse and abandonment were not uncommon. Only in the recent past has Tanette begun to publicly tell her story. She met Monique about 3 years ago and is a strong supporter of Arise for Girls because she knows firsthand what can happen to young girls without the proper support.